everything that people tell you about repeatedly about being a parent, raising a child, and having a tween is true. I mean, not everything. I have the most delightful, sweet, pleasant, good person tween that I've ever met. She's like an alien. We all think she's an alien. Everyone thinks she's an alien. She's just a delight. It might be growing up in a house with me, and I'm very strict, and I do not negotiate with terrorists. It might just be she was born this way. She's just a delight. But when they say the time flies, you can't get it back, it goes so quickly. You see car commercials. The father sees the little girl, and then all of a sudden she's 20 and she's got a brand new Nissan Sentra. Like, it's true. It goes so quickly. And there's a point where you still think your child is a baby. And it probably is like around 9 because they're still cute and little and like need you. And you're still telling them kind of what they want to, what you want them to do and what they're going to do, et cetera. I mean, they're a person. They can talk to you and be part of the decision. But then they really, the tween thing, they turn into like a person and their legs look so long and their bodies look normal. Like they're people, they're not babies. And it's really weird and it's creepy because you're like picking up this being that is, you could almost share clothes with, and it's like freaky. And so when they say it goes so quickly, I am so grateful and happy that no matter how hard I work on business and philanthropy, and it's really hard, that I'm so glad that I didn't have childcare or I had a baby nurse, but I didn't have a nanny and I don't really have childcare and I don't have babysitters. I'm with my kid all the time. It's, for me, it's work, kid, relationship, rotate. And philanthropy too. I just live for her. But I'm so glad I've put so much into it because I feel like I get so much out, but it does go so quickly. So even if your kids are older, and it's been amazing during the pandemic to really just have that extra time. And some people want to get their kids the hell out of the house because they're pains in the asses, but you just will never get the time back. And I just have always just been able to really see that and experience that in the moment. But another thing, if you're going through any kind of divorce and you worry about time and custody and all this stuff, your kid at a certain age really does decide who they are and what they want and what they think. And it comes more quickly than you would imagine. And what's more important than, you know, the amount of time and arguing over things that don't matter is really connecting, communicating with your kids, giving them a safe place to talk to you about relationships and about puberty and about if you have divorce, if you're from a divorced family, like what goes on, you know, in a divorce. And you got to talk to them. People like make these taboo topics, and being able to talk to your kids about therapy or what their little hearts feel, missing someone, adolescence, like, you know, if they have little crushes, are they real? Can you go back and remember when you were that age and how you felt? Like, all that stuff is really, really important stuff. And so while it's important to take care of our kids when they're young babies, it's really when they get to be tweens that you really start emotionally taking care of them. You're not just physically taking care of them and making sure they're safe. You have to watch the signs and see the cues when you have to be emotionally connecting with them and emotionally taking care of them. It's equally as important as physically taking care of them. And then, you know, they start to realize, you know, if you snap at them or you're in a mood or something, they feel the way you feel. And you can't just like snap and be like, put that down, you know, like when they're a little kid. That might hurt their feelings as they get older. And they also start to mimic you, and they start to listen more to everything you're saying, whether it's about your weight or gossiping a lot on the phone or being on the phone all day or buying or spending or wasting or anything. They just are little sponges, and they were spongy when they're babies, but they don't talk about them being so spongy when they're tweens. And this is when they really, you know, can become you or rebel against who you are. So you just have to really pay attention to how you're communicating with your kids and what the messaging is emotionally, physically, by example. I just think it's really, really important. And what you put in is what you get out. And you'll see that. And sometimes you feel like you're behind the eight ball, and you can always course correct. So don't feel frustrated if you feel like you haven't been spending enough time on that, you know, as much as other things. Sometimes we let the muscle get weak. You're on the phone a lot, you're shopping online, you're like not present, you're with your kids, but you're not really with them. Then it's been several hours and you think to yourself, you haven't really had that connected one-on-one time. They're running around, they're with their friends. It gets by you and you have to sort of work on it. I think I do really work on it. It's something I really pay a tremendous amount of attention to, more than anything else. And I'm proud of that. And it does mean something to me. So what do you think? What's your connection level to your kids? And, oh, that's what I meant. If your kids are getting a little out of control, or you feel like you aren't driving, I trained my dogs to not pee on rugs and like corners of surfaces after 5 years of age. They say you can't teach an old dog new tricks. Well, I just did it with two dogs. So you can retrain your kids too. My guest today is Stacy Madison. She is the founder of Stacy's Pita Chips, which she sold to Pepsi in 2006 for a reported $250 million in 2006. Her latest venture is Be Bold Bars, a delicious nut butter bar with high-end quality ingredients. And we are going to talk about using no as your motivation to forge forward, the importance of lack of waste in your business, and how it can launch innovation. Why bold doesn't always mean being fearless, and how you can always use your varied work background in your current business. Doesn't matter where you came from, use whatever got you here in your next venture. As you know, I talk all about Stacy's ingenuity and starting Stacy's Pita Chips all the time. And it was amazing to have her on the show and get to have this conversation. She is down to earth. She is all of you. She is a mom living in the suburbs. So if she could do it, so can you. And I think you're going to love our discussion. Hi.
Hi.
Do you know that I talk about you sometimes? Have you heard your name?
I didn't know that. I can't believe that either.
Okay, so I don't know your story, but the reason I wanted to talk to you is because, so there are certain people that I'll mention sometimes, like I'll use Michael Phelps in an analogy about hitting the wall in front of you, not looking left or right. Now, I don't know him and I don't know that much about him, but I'll just mention him. And so sometimes I'll say to people, you never know what it's going to be, what's going to hit. And only because I've peripherally heard what I think is your story. This is what I say. It could be half true. Stacy's Pita Store started as a sandwich store, and she used the leftover pita to make chips, and she sold it for like $60 million. So I say that to people, meaning don't be so focused on this one thing. You don't know what's going to pop. You could have 20 SKUs, and it could be one thing that you never expected. So that's my perception of that experience.
Yeah, I mean, that is true with the exception of our sales were at 60 million when we sold.
Oh, okay, got it.
But that is, all the rest is right.
I have been a natural food chef since 2000, and you, like myself, were doing this long before it was like cool, you know, before it was plant-based chefs and everyone was vegan and everything was oat milk. That this was back 20, you know, 20 years ago. This was not the conversation.
Yeah, they called us the tree huggers.
Exactly. So where you grew up in Massachusetts, tell me how you grew up and what money was in your household and what work ethic was and where this all started.
I grew up, my dad was a psychologist. My mom was a teacher. We lived in upstate New York until I was we moved to Massachusetts in 79 when I was a freshman in high school. And, you know, I was here for 4 years and then I went to UMass and then I went out to Cal State and I got my degree in social work. And then I came back and I lived and I worked down in DC and then back out in California and then like Hawaii. And I bounced around a lot before landing back here.
But financially, did you have a work ethic as a kid? Did your parents say you must work? You have to have a summer job? Did you look at rich people around you and say, I want that? What were your goals and what was your relationship with money? You want to be rich, you want to be successful, you don't care about money, that kind of thing.
I always worked in the summers. I always worked all through college. I had some great jobs. I had some terrible jobs. And yeah. And so it's kind of like, it wasn't something like a you must work kind of thing. It's just, you know, it's just was kind of, I just think I was raised that way with that kind of a work ethic. You know, my parents, even though my dad was a psychologist, he always had like these little things on the side. you know, he had Herman's sneaker and shoe outlet. So I think at some level he might have been, you know, like a like an underground entrepreneur kind of person. But you know, he had his, you know, his degree to support his family and to, you know, and all of that. But he always had a little gig on the side.
He had side hustles.
Yeah.
But back when no one talked about a brand or being an entrepreneur, none of that language existed. People had a job and whatever they did was a hobby otherwise. People didn't have side hustles. People weren't inventors. So you were working in social work, and how did you make the transition into sandwiches, and why did you think sandwiches were going to be a big business, or did you not? You just wanted to have a nice little cute little sandwich store and make a nice living.
So I always believe that, you know, if you, you know, what I think what I learned from, you know, being in jobs that you don't like is, you know, if you could make a living doing what you love to do each and every day, then it's not work. I'm obviously not the first one to say that, but you know, that's, I do live it. And it, whether, and that has really nothing to do with the financial part of it. You know, I had, I mean, I was on a food cart in downtown Boston with a master's degree, and Mark had a doctorate, and, you know, that's a very humbling experience.
That was your husband.
So Mark was, we had the whole gamut. He was a friend of my brother's, and then we were friends. That's how I met him. So we were friends, lovers, business partners, married, divorced, still in business together. And then eventually, you know, the road kind of forked and we went our own ways, and I started a family. And I'd like to say we had a successful divorce. And I say that all the time because it was a while before we ever even filed the papers, because it got really complex with, you know, with not being together, but still owning the business together. And we really didn't have any assets. All we had was the business. We were equally committed to the business because that was kind of like our child, right? That was our first
born. Wow. Okay. Well, this is a great question. And this is where we're getting into the meat of it. So were you careful in the beginning with him in signing everything? Or did you just say, oh, it's going to be fine? Were you 50-50 partners with someone 51, the deal breaker? Because when you, for people listening, when you start out, it's like nothing doesn't matter. Oh, it's fine. I'll get you back. You know, we'll figure it out later. Later's when it's complicated. So were you smart enough, was someone smart enough in the beginning to be organized and figure that stuff out?
Not at all. And we were 50-50. So everything was 50-50, but you know, we had brought other people into the business.
Okay.
And so my brother was in the business. So, you know, we agreed on giving him a cut, and then he brought a friend into the business and we agreed on giving him a cut. And then we had our CFO who really helped us get through the deal. And then we really felt that, you know, it was a team that built the pita chip company and that everybody should get something. And we had 300 people working there. And we felt like whether you worked there for the last month or whether you worked there throughout, like there should be, like everybody should get something. And they did. And they did. And even the investment banker told us that we were crazy. Nobody gives away this kind of money. And, you know, it's unheard of. And, you know, yeah, had we had the correct structures set up and all of this, then, you know, it certainly would have been easier. And, you know, that maybe, you know, I would do it differently today than we did then. But, you know, it was a lot of handshake deals, and it all worked out.
So you had 250 people. How did you manage this? How did you create this infrastructure? You're a small business. You're a startup. You don't know anything. How did you go about building this plane while flying it?
Well, we had, you know, it was a 9-year window. So when we started out, it was just myself, my brother, and Mark. And then from there, Mark brought in one of his friends to work on some of the machines. And then after that, we built out the team. And a lot of times we built out the team through, I mean, I used a ton of interns. I worked with Babson. I worked with Northeastern. I worked all the, you know, in here in Massachusetts, you have access to amazing universities. So we worked with a lot of them. And then a lot of those people came to work for us afterward. And in building out the team, you know, I would always say you need, it's click and tick, right? You need to find out if the person clicks, you know, if you click as people and the people around you. And then you also have to find out what makes that person tick. Okay. So I use this example all the time. There was this one woman, she worked for Nokia and she had like a really high paying job and she was excellent. We never thought we would be able to afford her. She came to us and she was at Nokia. She was not able to teach her yoga class or take her yoga class or whatever on Tuesday afternoons. And we were like, and she was willing to sacrifice salary, to sacrifice everything. But she was like, you know what? My one thing is that I need to have Tuesday afternoons off. And other people, it's like, oh, I have something with my kids. And I have that. But as a small business and as you're growing, those are the places where you can add value to somebody's life and they can be committed to you and you can be flexible.
That's amazing. That's great.
And a lot of times what makes them tick is more important than what they're going to get paid. And you have to, and we've found basically that giving people a window to work together is going to be able, you're going to be able to tell, they're going to be able to tell if they like you guys and if it's, they're comfortable working with us and we're comfortable working with them. And, you know,
okay, well, you just went into the machinery and stuff like that. So that costs money. You were working in a sandwich cart. Did you have a sandwich store ever after the cart? And that's where the pita chips came from. Where were you making these? You had a sandwich cart. You then use the leftover pita to make the pita chips. That's the ultimate pivot, which is the most popular word during the pandemic. So talk to people about they're doing this one business. Sometimes you only can see one inch in front of your face and you may have to just step back, take a deep breath and figure out how to get through the window if you can't get through the door. So now you're schlepping sandwiches and then what happens?
So we bought a food cart and we put it out in downtown Boston. We had come back from Hawaii and the West Coast and where it was
like a truck or a cart, like a truck or one of those little carts.
It was a cart. There was a cart with like four wheels and we'd wheel it up the street and then we took like, and we lifted up the awning and then, you know, it was a converted sausage cart that we'd made into almost like a deli station. And we would prepare the food. My sister had a catering company in downtown Boston. We would prepare the food at her location. We would bring it out to the cart in coolers, really. We would load up the cart and we would decorate it with like tomatoes and, you know, it would look really healthy and pretty. And we had a huge line and we served sandwiches rolled in pita bread. And like I said, out West, you have easy access to food, healthy food everywhere. But, you know, this was, you know, in the 90s and it's like there was nothing.
I remember the place that was in Warren Towers that was in Boston on the ground floor. And they used to use like this sort of like Greek almost hummusy tahini and they would use pita and they rolled sandwiches up and it was so popular.
And was it super salad? And they called it a walkabout.
I don't remember what it was, but I was obsessed with it. So you wanted to do this because your idea was healthy food on the go. That was the idea?
Yes. And so we had, you know, we made all our dressings. We made everything and we made sandwiches rolled in pita bread.
Was this to code? Were you following rules?
Yes. Yeah. Well, this business was. I've had other ones where it wasn't, but this one was. But you know, so we did prepare it in a commercial kitchen and we brought everything, you know, there. We had our vendor's license or, you know, peddler's license or whatever you want to call it. And so you can run out of anything on a food cart, right? Or in any lunch establishment, you can run out of alfalfa sprouts or tomatoes or what have you. But if you run out of bread and you're serving roll up sandwiches, you are done for the day. So we always had a fresh inventory of pita bread.
Wow.
And so at the end of the day, we would cut it up. We would bake it into different flavor chips and we would serve and we would just hand them out for free to people standing in line.
Whose idea was that? Do you remember?
I think it was both of ours. I mean, Mark definitely with the recipe. I think there might have been one pita chip out there that was a fried chip and we weren't, you know, we would never do a fried chip. And so we, you know, Mark created the recipe and we're like, what are we going to do with this bread? And that's, you know, I mean, it was simple, but, you know, then we kind of kept it, when you are in downtown Boston and it is October, getting into October, and it is cold. It's cold. And I don't know, it's, you know, we didn't have Uber Eats. We didn't have any kind of delivery service. We didn't have any of that around. We didn't have, you know, all we had for the internet was like, we had a website and email. There was no social media or anything like that.
Right. Of course.
So it was a very different way to build a business, as I think a lot of the ways that businesses are built today.
Right. So you were giving out, well, the guy, I think it's the guy who created Pirate's Booty. Years ago, I reached out to him and I think he said, put the product in the people's mouths. We don't pay for advertising. So you were doing that. So then what? Everybody online who felt like they were part of a whole thing, which sounds amazing. You created a little culture. It sounds like the brand had a culture from the beginning. Even just giving out pita chips to people online because they were cold is sweet and cute, and I get it.
But it's like, you know, it's cold outside and you don't want to stay. You can't stay outside through the winter. So it was when it started getting really cold, and we that's when we started over the cold season. We started doing what we needed to do in order to market the chips. We went to trade shows. We went to, we developed, you know, I worked on the packaging and got a bag, put them in a bag and got a place to make them. And then just walked into what was at the time Bread and Circus. It wasn't Whole Foods yet. And, you know, hi, I'm Stacy. This is my chip. This is my bag of chips. You want to try them? And how do I get into your store? And yeah. And a lot of times it's like people are like, oh, how did you do that? How did you get into the store? I'm like, I just walked in and said, how do I do this? And a lot of times that is what it is, like that networking and that just, you got to have that bravado to just move it and do it and try it.
Yeah, I like that. How did you navigate the deal? How did you know that you were doing the right thing? How did you know not to stay in? How was your head exploding? I mean, how did you navigate that? Just with professionals?
So when we were at a trade show, we were approached by, you know, one of the global leaders. And, you know, we said, we're really not interested in selling. And then when, you know, and they said, well, when you get to the point where you're selling 50 million in sales, you're going to have a lot more interest and da, 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 da. So we just want to make sure that, you know us and we know you and et cetera, et cetera. Then fast forward another, you know, almost a year later, we're at another trade show. We meet the same person again. And we start kind of having a conversation, like being courted, I guess. And then within 90 days, we were contacted by like three more. And all of a sudden, we now have, you know, these global leaders in the food industry that are interested in our brand. And that's when we said, you know, maybe we should consider it. And we got, we started interviewing investment bankers. And you could tell instantly when you came to the pita chip factory, there was a sign on the door that said no ties allowed. And you could tell instantly with the people who walked in, or some people are down in the lobby and they're like, okay, take off your tie. You know, and they're like, I'm doing, and you know, all the, like, but we found a perfect match. You know, we found, you know, Houlihan Loki in Chicago and this one guy, Jay Novak, who just spoke our language, and there wasn't a bakery in the country that he hadn't been in. And he was willing to put skin in the game with us. He was just that kind of a guy. And, you know, you have to find believers, and he was a believer. And so, you know, we got an investment banker, we got an accounting team, we got a law firm. And so that when they put it up, basically put it up for sale.
Well, right. Most people don't realize that sometimes you just get approached, like I did, by Beam Global. And I really did not like my investment banker, my partner brought somebody in. I didn't know anything. So fine. I didn't like him. And I think he was courting the person who was buying me to do other deals with them. And I felt scummy and slimy. And we did a good deal. The deal that I did then would have been probably $1 billion now based on the cases that we did, because now it's more in to have liquor brands. And we had done 360,000 cases in a year, and we would have done 500,000. We didn't have the supply. So that would be definitely with bees in it now. But, you know,
it's funny because our COO, okay, so she had worked for us at the pita chip company. We got her from, she was working for Quaker.
Oh, okay.
And we got her from Quaker. She wanted a small business experience. She was one of those people that, you know, courted us for a long time. And we, you know, eventually we were like, we don't have the money to hire you. And finally we did get the money and we did hire her. And then, after the acquisition, because we were purchased by Pepsi, who owns everything, right? Tropicana and Quaker and Frito and all of those. So we got acquired, and then she ended up back working for the company that we originally took her from. And then she went to work for Jim Beam. And so she knows, she is a huge fan of yours, and she met you once, and she's like, she said, no, she was there during your acquisition and all of that. And now she's back running the bold bars.
That's amazing. Yeah. So many people don't realize that sometimes you get tapped by one person, and there aren't as many people in the liquor business to buy as there are in the snack business to buy. I mean, you could be bought by Unilever, Procter & Gamble, any, you know, Frito-Lay, whoever.
Yeah.
So what sales were you doing? So anyway, the point I'm trying to make to people at home is that it can be like a proactive, like, hi, we're for sale. Like, you're putting your house on the market, which seems counterintuitive, because to me, it's sort of like, oh, wait, I want someone to knock on my door and say, hi, we want to buy you, you know, because of all the press I get and because of the shows I do. And I always wonder, A, if I should ever sell, B, if I should sell a piece. I've talked to Mark Cuban about this. But C, you kind of sometimes have to say, hi, we're open for business. Even though you had people tap you, you had to get organized to know what the hell you're talking about. So how much in sales were you doing when you had all these people tapping you on the shoulder? And I wonder if that was also the time, like my situation, where the time was different then, and now there are so many more snack companies than then. Or I'm just wondering about the landscape and what your sales were before people came.
So we were at about 60 or 65 million in sales a year.
Wow. Okay. And also knowing when to hold them, when to fold them, you could have had anything happen. You could have had a lawsuit happen. You could have had a bad bag of chips. You could have had bad press. Anything could happen. And now with cancel culture, it's scary. And you just, you know, you don't know. Pigs get fat and hogs get slaughtered. You just don't know how far to go sometimes. And so have you ever regretted selling, and have you ever regretted not staying in a little bit when you see how big the brand is? I don't know how big the brand is now. I assume huge.
So I did stay for a while.
But because it was part of the deal, they put it in the deal, you had to stay, not because you had another back end, right?
Right. There was no additional buyout clause or, you know, or thing like that. And we had different offers for different amounts of money. And there was even one that was more, but it did have clauses like that. And we just didn't want that. And I have to tell you, be honest, Bethany, it was a time where, you know, I had twins. Like, yes, I planned on you know, getting pregnant. I went to Boston IVF. I got the, I picked out a donor. I felt like I was financially and emotionally ready to have a child, and then went for my ultrasound, and they're like, okay, here's a heartbeat. And then they go like this, and here's another one. And I almost, you know, I started again crying and like, oh my God, what am I going to do? Like, I planned on having one child, not two children. And I had an apartment in Boston, and I had no parking, 110-pound dog, twins on the way. I was like, what the fuck am I going to do?
Right.
You know,
you wanted to get off the ride a little bit. Didn't you want to get off? I mean, I feel that sometimes you want to get off the goddamn ride for a minute.
I was, you know, and I had the company until they were three.
Right. That's still very like young. That's still,
it was a lot. I mean, I had help at that point. You know, I did have someone helping me with the kids and bringing them over every day, but you know, it was a lot. It was just a tremendous, it was a lot. And, at the same time, you know, Mark had never had the opportunity to do as much traveling as he wanted to do. I think he was ready to check out, and I was being torn in so many directions. And we, that's why we were like, you know what? That's when we sat down. We were like, you know, I think we're done.
Wow. And that 9 years though, for everybody, that's, you know, my Skinny Girl has been around the whole brand. I own 100% of the brand besides the cocktails, and I'm going back into wine and Forever Young, my new brand. But it's been around for over a decade. And so you're talking about 9 years. That's a long, you know, that's a lot of pita chips, a lot of sandwiches, a lot of hard work. And do you feel like it's totally earned, or do you feel like you overshot the mark? Like, do you feel like, wow, we got lucky, you know, or lucky, how much smart, you know?
Yeah. So certainly timing was right. But I do get a little, it does kind of, well, for lack of a better way to say it, it does go up my ass sideways when people say, oh, she got lucky, because they just don't understand, like, all of those little decisions that you have to make on a day-to-day basis that go into the business that you have to make correctly.
Right, right. By the way, that's the best thing you've said all day. I had a girl who used to say to me, it's funny because I was in a relationship with someone who said to me, it's the only person in my whole life who's ever said, you got lucky. And I wanted to punch him in the face because I was like, you're the fucking only person who's ever said this to me. There's nothing about the shit that's luck. This is all intention. And this girl that I know said to me, you make all the right moves. Now, obviously, maybe I don't make all the right moves, but I'm playing chess at all times, always making a decision. And if that one goes wrong, you find that piece, you walk it back, you navigate it, you massage it. It's all very intentional.
And that's the difference. I mean, we almost had all that goes into selling a company, right? And then
it could almost not happen. Every time. How long did it take? $1 million in legal in almost a year or something? How long did it take?
It took a long time. In the for sale world, it was fast. But in our world, it was not fast. You know, we kind of made it happen in less than a year, but it was, I think, 8 or 9 months.
But think about that, people. Mine was $1 million in legal. And the day before, I looked at my partner, which I'll never forget. I said to him, I don't know if I want to do this. I don't know if I want to do this. It's like breaking up with someone, having a baby, not having a baby. Literally. And he goes, all right, so we won't do it. $1 million in legal. We owed the money and we almost didn't do it because I got emotional. So the point is, the way you carve out every single thing that's ever going to happen is intentional. Even if you don't know contracts, you might know concepts.
So Bethany, we had signed that purchase and sale, right? Sell the company. And then we had a 5-alarm fire.
Like literally a 5-alarm fire.
Literally. You know, we had a 300,000 square foot facility and some pita bread came off the line and went up on this cooling conveyor, and the bread caught on fire as it came off the line. Then the conveyor caught on fire, and then it went like on the cooling conveyor, like a Christmas tree, burnt right through the roof. People are in there scattering. There's a guy up on a forklift trying to fight a fire. And I mean, oh my God. And here we had signed the deal. And so that whole thing could have fallen apart at that point. And, you know, and I think at the time Mark was away and we were like, you better come home. My brother was away. You better come home. I'm standing in the parking lot. The firefighter gave me like those big boot galoshes and I'm standing there with water. I think I was in shock. I think I was really in shock. I was freezing. I was shivering. My boots were in water and I'm looking around and you know what? And then people started to show up. People who worked in the factory, the woman I told you about, they all kind of came and they were like, we'll rebuild it.
Wow.
We're going to get it. And then I get a phone call. Like I didn't even have a chance. I get a phone call. I'm almost crying now, right? I get a phone call from Irene Rosenfeld, who was at the time running Frito. Now she runs Kraft. I get a call from Irene and she says, anything you want to tell me?
Oh, like she thought she'd set your business on fire?
Like I'm literally in the parking lot as they put out this fire. And I don't know how she knew, but she's like, anything you want to tell me about? And I was just like, we'll rebuild it. And then my brother came and he's like, you know, she's like, I think I need to come and see it for myself. And I mean, and really, like made like 75% of the factory was gone. You know, we had a good brand, but we kind of burnt down the factory in the middle of the company.
That's insane.
So, and what wasn't smoked, what wasn't like damaged from the fire was like water and smoke and all of this. And we still have a company to run and we have to produce.
Fill orders. No, well that, yeah.
So yeah, it was a long time, but you know what? That's when all of your networking and people kind of came together and they came up, they saw it. We cleaned up as best we could. They saw the factory. They saw how, you know, we kind of blocked off half of it. The Randolph firefighters were excellent and coming and, you know, the health department blocked off part of it. We rebuilt on the other side of it. And with like, within like, we were supposed to close in December, beginning of December. And we ended up closing in January the following year. It was like 4 or 6 weeks later or something that we rebuilt the factory. And I remember my brother and, you know, some of the engineers from Frida, they go, we've had fires too.
Wow.
We know what it's like. And we're like, and so they really were purchasing the brand. The factory's still there and we did rebuild it. And they never believed that we would get it done in a month, not only a month, but it was Christmas and trying to get plumbers and electricians and, you know, people are off on vacation and stuff. So, but we took that month and we got the factory rebuilt. And my brother was saying to them, you know, not only, well, look at the bright side. Not only are you going to have a factory, you're going to have a brand new factory.
No, not only that, look who you invested in, what we could do.
And you know, we had, you know, luckily we had business interruption insurance. So the insurance company was on board. We got to get these people back up and running, balls to the walls as fast as we can. And yeah. And so we did, we built them a new factory and they said they came back in and, you know, they could have backed out at the deal at that time and they didn't. And they came back in and they said, wow, we're impressed.
Oh, you were saying it wasn't signed yet. It was in between the time that you have an agreement, but the papers have, you didn't do that 10,000 papers in the lawyer's office. That's the interesting part of the story. Wow. No.
It's called a MAC, a material adverse clause, or I don't know, something like that. That's basically anything short of like a tornado or a fire. You know, we've never had a MAC, the lawyer said. And then I'm like, oh my God. So it gives them the opportunity. At that point, they could have backed out.
Right. Well, that's what I was saying to you about when pigs get fat and hogs get slaughtered, anything can happen. So sometimes you have to know when to hold them and when to fold them. So I was going to say, you have a very interesting story, and I'm sure that my audience doesn't know any of it because I don't know any of it. I know one little line and I wasn't even right. So it's going to help a lot of people because you're a single mom, two IVF kids, and you were counting your change for your laundry. And here you are, a successful woman going back in with another business, working as hard as you did before, I assume, because now you're not raising kids the same way. And I'm impressed. I think it's great. And it's a great, like, you're a great role model for other people.
Well, I have to ask you this. So, you know, and I know that you've put out books and stuff like that, right? So I was working with a publisher. They asked me, you know, to write a book, and I didn't end up doing it because I only have another year left with my kids before they go off to college with my twins, my twin girls. And one of the reasons why we didn't do the book was because I don't have enough followers. I'm like, so much easier to write a book, I guess, if you have a gazillion followers. Then I literally just started my Instagram not that long ago. And they're like, well, why don't you wait until you build up some of your social media presence and this and that? And I'm kind of like, you know, this whole social media thing. I mean, I'd love to talk to you about it sometime.
No, we could. It sucks. I hate it more than anything.
It's like a blessing and a curse. You know, I don't want to expose myself personally all out there, but at the same time, if I don't expose myself personally all out there, then how am I going to get more than my 1,000 followers?
I hate it more than anything. Just so you know, I really do. I hate it. I'm getting better at it because I pay some attention to it. And you obviously have to hire people just like you're making pita chips to help you with it, but it has to be true to who you are. It sounds like you're passionate about building Be Bold. So my instinct is that your book should be called Be Bold, and you should really be building that as the platform versus necessarily you. You can't build both at the same time. So I think a book, Be Bold by Stacey Madison, and you're building that brand. It just would be hard to build your own social and that, and you're trying to build that as a business anyway. So hire, you know, the right person to help you build that social and then write the book with that brand, I think. It'd be like if you would write it, if you started Kind Bar, I'd tell you to write a book called Be Kind. You know what I'm saying? About the building of a brand, you know, because what you did with Stacy's Pita Chips was be bold. So you're accomplishing many different things at the same time. But if you want, I have a marketplace.
Yeah.
And we started like a month and a half ago, and we already, just because of my juice cleansing, got 8,000 hits on one thing. And you could contribute. We have Be Partners. So we could have you be a partner and build up your following because we promote these people on social. So it's great for you.
Thank you. And I hear you're, and so now you're in Massachusetts. So that's awesome.
And I can help you with the book stuff. But yeah, build up to 10, 15,000, you know, but everything isn't about social media. It's almost canceling itself out. There are people that have 30 million followers on TikTok that, you know, not everyone cares about in every other space, to be honest. Like, so some of it's bullshit. Something will happen to me on Twitter. I'll think I've been canceled and I'll be in the mainstream space and nobody even knows what the hell happened. So, you know, yes, social media is hugely important. We all get it. But it's like there are people way less successful than me, that have way more followers than me. So whatever that means. I should have way more followers, but I don't have time to take thong bikini pictures all day. I'm running a fucking business. You know what I mean? I could go outside, put the tassels on my titties and take pictures and get some followers, but I got to run this goddamn business. So
I just think you're amazing.
Awesome. Thanks, Stacey. Have a great day.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
So that was Stacey Madison, the founder of Stacey's Pita Chips. That was very different and interesting because, truthfully, if I met her at a coffee shop or at a spin class or just in a shop, I would just think she was sort of just like a cool, pretty, down-to-earth mom, like a suburban mom. This suburban mom sold her pita chip company, which was leftover pita bread from a sandwich cart, for $250 million in 2006. That was 15 years ago, okay? That, I'm not great at this, but that would probably be $354, $500 million. You know, no, not that much, but it would be a lot more now. So good for her. Great wisdom, advice. It was different. It's just good for you if you're a mom and you're home and you just think it couldn't be you. You're not good enough. You're not smart enough. You don't know enough about business. You don't know enough about contracts. You didn't go to college. You didn't go to business school. Who cares? She came together with her family and she provided good ingredients. She was passionate about it. She started from the bottom. She had a degree and yet she really started from the bottom. Like me, I used to schlep. I used to stay up 24 hours in a row and deliver cookies in my $500 Bronco with a cracked windshield. And I was exhausted. And I would do it every week over and over again. And I remember, like it was yesterday, it was exhausting. But, you know, people who are successful really started off working hard. So this is a mom who was passionate and just made it happen with decisions, hard work, passion, drive, and determination. Great conversation, great inspiration if you are a mom at home just wanting to be a business person, because you probably already are a business person. Just Be is hosted and executive produced by me, Bethany Frankel. Just Be is a production of Be Real Productions and iHeartRadio. Our managing producer is Fiona Smith and our producer is Stephanie Stender. Our EP is Morgan Lavoie. To catch more moments from the show, follow us on Instagram at Just Be with Bethany.